Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. You probably know what it feels like to be an outsider, not part of the in crowd. That used to be a bad thing, but not anymore.
Here's to the crazy ones, the rebels, the troublemakers, the ones who see things differently. While some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, how misfits, outsiders, geeks, and rebels gained social status and economic clout. To the point that today you could say the outsiders are the new in crowd. So one of the books that got us thinking about this is Alyssa Quart's Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Dreamers, and Rebels. Her definition of outsider is pretty expansive, ranges from indie filmmakers and musicians to transgender activists and bipolar pride supporters. For example, she writes about the Icarus Project.
So the Icarus Project started in 2002, and they were a couple of kids, really. They were young people who had had nervous breakdowns, or that was how the world thought what had happened to them. They had gotten to a state, they were sometimes young as college students, and something had happened, and they had been institutionalized. After that, there's a couple of people in this group. One of them was Sasha DeBrule. Another one is somebody named Jax Ashley McNamara. And they decided they wanted to organize a movement which would potentially offer alternative strategies for dealing with mental states, extreme mental states.
What do you mean alternative strategies?
Not being put in institutional settings necessarily if they had a breakdown, sometimes not being given psychopharmacological assistance, healing in groups, having a lot of community peer-to-peer counseling, and generally, you know, doing a lot of peer education in communities that didn't even have adequate psychiatric services. If a young person wanted to get the help they needed, they couldn't afford to. So that was part of what Icarus Project decided to do. And when I wrote about them, there was up to 15,000 members. So they were kind of growing, and they had gotten a lot of, suddenly around the time my book came out, people were starting to take some of their ideas and run with them. There were articles about them.
So they'd become a community.
Yes.
A social movement, I guess.
A social movement, and on a web movement too. I mean, they had community groups, and they have informational packets that people are downloading online and so forth. And they'd have meetings across the country in various locations. Unlike Alcoholics Anonymous, they would come out and they'd be talking, and I think often their identities were not hidden. You know, they'd be out and proud about being insane in the eyes of the world. And what does that mean? And this whole idea that madness was not just something terrible to be cured, but this is the language they use, it's a dangerous gift.
Hmm. So this is about more than combating the stigma of mental illness. It's challenging established norms, you know, by saying who says mental illness is bad or wrong.
Exactly. And it was a real challenge. It was a challenge to me as a writer and reporter not to be concerned, oh, what's going to happen to some of the people I'm talking to if they're not taking medication?
Yeah.
Or if they're taking a new blend of medication and self-care, is that going to be enough for them? Is that going to be a good message, even if they have self-control, to preach to broader audiences? But I felt like a lot of people who were influenced by this group, they did have a sort of moderate approach. Like they were just have vegetarian diets and yoga and all these kind of healthy things in community conversation. And also they would take some medication. It just was not to the many, many different kinds of medication that they might have been on by their conventional providers. And so they were mixing it together, the alternative and the mainstream. But I mean, yeah, the removal of stigma, I think, was the main thing that they were trying to achieve, along with rebranding, if you will, of what insanity means.
Hmm. Yeah, that's another strategy, I guess, that you began to see repeated amongst different kinds of outsider groups. I mean, there are a few strategies it seems like you found in common, and this rebranding or redefining of language seems kind of crucial.
Yeah, I mean, the rebranding of language, people were doing that. They were talking to me about how they were trying to change their standing in the world. And one thing that kept coming up was language. So one of the chapters in my book was about autistic activists. Some of them would define themselves as having Asperger's, so different kinds of neurological states than the rest of us. And they call themselves neurodiverse. Hmm. And they might call me or you neurotypical. So that was the use of language to try to make definitions that were surprising. So as opposed to being just a diagnostic label, they were something almost positive, neurodiverse. They were more able than you and I to find connections that, say, I couldn't see. There were also, amongst the extreme animal rights activists I wrote about, they called animals non-human animals to emphasize the relationship between humans and animals so that every meat eater might be given even more pause when they set about carving up their steak. You know, oh, I'm eating a non-human animal.
That's really interesting how just changing the terminology we use can telescope so much.
I mean, I really do think so. And it was consistent throughout every group that I wrote about in Republic of Outsiders, that those shifts of language, you know, the crafters who called themselves craftivists. Hmm. So they were trying to just say crafting isn't just your grandmother's knitting. It's this way of seeing what shopping is, or way of seeing what leisure activity is. It's an activism.
And some of the most powerful examples of that has to do when you start looking at the trans community. There you see the creation of a whole new set of terms and new language for thinking about gender.
Absolutely. So the central figure in my chapter about transgender people was this guy called Ray. And Ray was a trans man who I met when he was a student at a women's college in New York City, Barnard. And Ray's journey at that time was very different than today in the age of, you know, Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox. The big similarity is that he went online when he was 14 or 13 years old and said, why do I feel like I do? And then he discovered, you know, the transgender community and language and surgery and all sorts of things that could change who he was so he was more the person he felt he was. I mean, he'd been transitioning when I met him. He had a bar mitzvah at 18, which was really interesting. And then he set about a whole life in a gender different from the one he was born in.
And this was one of the first cases, right, on college campuses that sort of challenged college administrators and other students, because, as you say, he went to a women's college, I think. Don't I remember that some of the women students had issues with that?
Yeah, he went to Barnard, and at that point it was the very beginning of some of this awareness. I mean, it was still a little, I mean, it's so strange how fast this has been. This was 7 or 6 years ago. But at that point, some of the administrators weren't sure what to do with him. You know, he had entered the college as a young woman, and now he was a man, a trans man, and they didn't know what to do. They're like, where should he live? Should he stay here? You know, there's a lot of questions around it. And that was happening in some other women's colleges at that time, at Smith and Wellesley. And so I talked to a lot of students during that period who defined themselves as, and here's another word, gender nonconforming. Hmm. And yet they were going to women's colleges. So it was a sort of interesting test case. What happens to feminism when it means a woman's space, a woman's only space, is now has to admit men? So what happens to feminism then?
You know, it strikes me that what you're talking about is people who are not just trying to redefine the meaning of normal as really kind of pushing against the entire concept of normal. Because rather than just, you know, saying, well, I'm going to switch my gender, Ray and so many others like him are trying to really throw out the entire concept of gender, just say, no, it's not black and white, male or female. I'm gender fluid.
Yeah, I mean, I think he said, I can't be put in a box. I can't be put in a binary. You know, I think in different ways. And that's something that you sometimes see. It's not across the board in the trans community. I mean, I think there are definitely trans people who, I don't mean to speak for the trans community, but there are trans people who very much identify with the gender that they are now. More, you know, they don't see themselves as living on some continuum. They're like, I am now a trans woman. I am now a trans man. The other part of my life is done. But then there are people who see themselves living on a gender continuum, you know, with many different kinds of gender identities going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting. I mean, and the young people I was talking to for my book, they were articulating different positions around that too. Part of the outsider thing now is these are continuums. So what is normal and what is not normal is like constantly shifting. And it's a sort of a spectrum. especially some of the people living with this outsider mentality, you know, the neurodiverse and the mad pride people and some of the trans feminists, gender nonconforming people, is they see where normal ends and unusual begins as changing, as shifting. And that's part of what their work is, to try to make the line move a little.
Well, and going back to your saying that we're, in a sense, all on a spectrum, that's maybe the way the people who are talking about being neurotypical versus neurodiverse, or people who are thinking about being gender fluid, they're wanting to break down the old polarities, the dichotomies. So maybe in fact, where we're going is not you're an outsider or you're an insider, you're alternative or you're mainstream. Maybe where we're going is, you know, we're all somewhere in the middle.
One of the takeaways I had from this book was just so many people are made up of outsider and inside identities, like single people. You know, I said at one point, the outsider in ourselves and the outsider in myself, in you. And we have different parts of us that exist in different ways. So maybe it's like lots of different pieces of each person are on different spectrums, which sounds like incredibly complicated. But I think it actually is probably how it works.
Alyssa Quart is the author of Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Dreamers, and Rebels. Back in 1956, the philosopher Colin Wilson wrote a bestseller called The Outsider. It's a study of misfit artists and writers like Kafka, Van Gogh, and Dostoevsky. The book has never been out of print, and it's still considered the classic work on alienation and the modern psyche. Here's Blair Lorimer from the Star of the System YouTube channel with a review.
The purpose of this is to recommend a book to you. It is The Outsider by Colin Wilson. Basically, the outsider is you. You, the listener, it's me.
Every day starts with a broken heart. I must be too sensitive for this world. Well, I know it ain't right to cry every night. I must be too sensitive for this world.
We are the ones who see and feel too deeply.
And the world is such a callous place. It's a wonder. It's a wonder.
It's a wonder.
Anyone survive?
Too sensitive for this world.
One of the important things that they said was, it's like when you see and feel too deeply, you get a vision of beyond the transparent reality, which is actually unreal, to the depths of what really is there, almost like a vision, you know, like William Blake or something like that. But when they come back from that to, you know, 3D world reality, and they can never recapture that, it's only momentary capturing. I know, like, say, Van Gogh and his paintings, but he was miserable most of his life, but there were moments of brilliance when he actually saw reality as reality, and he was at one when he was being creative. And when they came back, they felt like, no, they wanted life to be like that all the time. It's absolutely fascinating. You know, I cannot recommend this book highly enough.
That's Blair Lorimer from the Star of the System YouTube channel with his thoughts about The Outsider by Colin Wilson. Coming up, we'll uncover the underground innovation of the misfit economy. Also, the life and times of Joseph Mitchell, the legendary New Yorker writer who profiled people on the fringes, saloon keepers, street preachers, and a bearded lady. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Do you remember that scene in Pirates of the Caribbean when Keith Richards makes a cameo appearance as Captain Teague? The International Brethren of Pirates are all standing around arguing about their pirate's code, and then Keith Richards ends the argument by shooting one of them and announcing, "The code is the law." Well, there's actually some historical truth there, because a lot of those swashbuckling 18th century pirates were actually early adopters of constitutions. I mean, this is back before constitutions existed in Western Europe, and pirates were writing their own and using them to govern their ships and trade. That's just one of the stories that Alexa Clay and Kira Maya Phillips tell in their new book, The Misfit Economy: Lessons in Creativity from Pirates, Hackers, Gangsters, and Other Informal Entrepreneurs. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with them.
Alexa, you argue that the free market economy does not possess a monopoly on innovation, but there seems to be a perception that it does. So what is wrong with this view of the way the market economy works?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that we really tried to look at in the misfit economy was bring attention to the fringe economies. So around the world, in some countries, over 70% of the economies are informal. And the informal economy accounts for over $10 trillion. So we really wanted to expand this idea of who are the innovators, who are the entrepreneurs, beyond just a trope of Mark Zuckerberg type folks from Silicon Valley or hoodie-wearing college dropouts who go out to start tech companies, and really look at broader ideas of entrepreneurs, thinking about ways in which drug dealers or street hawkers or gangsters have entrepreneurial potential. We looked at hackers and Somali pirates as well.
So when you talk about the misfit economy, some of it you might be referring to is illegal, but some might not be.
Yeah, exactly. We basically focus on two different types of misfits. We focus on misfits that are really working to transform economies that are underground. But then we also look at misfits within our formal system. So folks working within huge institutions or multinational companies that are really trying to transform those organizations from within. And these aren't just saboteurs or whistleblowers, but they're proactively hacking those cultures. They're developing new, say, environmental or social business models within those companies.
When you say that we all have something of an inner misfit within us, can you explain why you think that?
I had a much more esoteric background growing up. Both my parents were anthropologists. You know, my mother researched alien abduction. I was taught in Quaker schools and alternative schools. So my first exposure to corporations was after college. And suddenly I was in this almost corporate heart of darkness. And I really thought of myself as an anthropologist, really trying to understand what makes business tick. And it was just interesting to me how conformist of a culture it was and how people really had to conform to a job description and leave so much of who they were behind. They didn't come into work with the full actualization of all their personality. They really came in camouflaged, if you will. And so part of the people that I started finding really interesting were misfits that wouldn't do that camouflaging, that really brought all their values into work. Someone like Dave Burdish, for example, who was a third-generation auto worker at Ford, who was a devout Catholic and human rights activist and started bringing those conversations into Ford Motor Company, which was incredible. So that's how it really got started for me. Kira, do you want to share?
The goal of the book personally for me is to get people to realize that if we listen to the aspects of ourselves that we feel really uncomfortable with, we can learn a lot. But also, if you take that externally, if you listen to the misfit who really shakes you to your core, who makes you feel the most uncomfortable, that we can also learn a lot. So it's sort of less about the specific lessons from a pirate or a hacker or a gangster, but more about realizing that perhaps it's the people who you least expect you to teach you anything who perhaps can end up teaching you the most.
So does this apply to your own life? I mean, were there certain parts of your life that you were not very comfortable with and you somehow figured out how to embrace that piece of you?
I think that generally I definitely had that lesson, absolutely, to stop silencing the parts of myself that I, didn't particularly like.
Can you give me examples of that?
I can share. Do you want to think?
Yeah, no, go ahead and I'll have it.
Some of the folks that really inspired me to just be much more out there were some of the performance artists and activists that we spoke to. So the Yes Men or La Barbe, which is a fantastic French feminist group that wear fake mustaches and dress up as men and go to events that are very male-dominated and congratulate the man on being so amazing and masculine. And they just have this really interventionist kind of thing. And in parallel to that was really inspired by Plain People and by Luddite communities around the world that we spoke to. And so I started doing this performance character as a result of some of the research where I would dress up as an Amish woman and go to tech conferences and just be kind of Socratic with tech founders, really pushing them to think a bit more about what their legacy is in the world and how they want to change the world and whether or not we really need that app that they're developing, and just having conversations about the role that these digital technologies are having on our relationships and our intimacy and things like that. And so I think the project and this research and meeting different types of misfits has just really emboldened me to do things that are a bit more interventionist in nature. And, you know, one of the principles that we talk a lot about in the book is around just the nature of provocation, that just igniting a conversation or intervening in an appropriate moment and having the moral courage to do that can be equally important to something that has great structure or great legacy.
Absolutely. And I we had a chat with this incredible guy called Dwayne Jackson, and he was a former drug trafficker, and he grew up in children's homes his whole life in the East End of London. When he was 15, he got kicked out of school, and then when he was 20, he was arrested for trying to smuggle drugs from England to the United States. And 10 years since his arrest, he's founded his own tech company and grown it and sold it successfully. But in speaking to him, the lessons that we got from him were less business lessons and more kind of life lessons. Certain things that he said really, really impacted me personally. He talked about how growing up in care allowed him to navigate uncertainty and how he doesn't seek for completeness or fact or reason, and that he prefers to live the questions rather than seeking answers all the time. And that really taught me a lot about not always wanting to know what's going to happen and therefore be more in the present moment. So there were definitely lessons in terms of how to live a good life from a lot of the people that we met.
I was struck by how, I mean, you talked with various people who've had prison records. I mean, who've spent time in prison and sort of had to learn how to cope with that and what to do with that. And some of them really turned their lives around.
We were so incredibly impressed by that. Some of the lessons that came through from their experiences in prison, for example, is how to pay attention to the world around you. The guy who I was just talking about, Dwayne Jackson, he said that 90% of the time that you're in prison is boring, and you have so much time to observe your environment, so you become extremely perceptive. And that, together with the fact that you have to make do with very limited resources around you, means that everything that you look at takes on additional meaning and every detail matters. And that's really helped them both in their personal lives, but also from an entrepreneurial or business perspective.
And there's another guy you write about, Antonio Fernandez, who you say is an example of what you call the pivot. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. Antonio, or King Tone, as he was known, was the leader of the Latin Kings. He's just incredible. I mean, I think part of the people that are in the book are folks that we just really liked. And these aren't just folks that are born into criminal cultures or those types of worlds, but they're actively going, even trying to transform those. And so at the time that King Tone inherited the leadership of the Latin Kings, which is a Hispanic street gang, it was recovering from one of its bloodiest periods.
And then they had a reputation of being a really violent street gang.
Horribly. Yeah. And that was Mission Drift. You know, the organization started off in Chicago very much as a cultural organization, as a celebration of Latino identity. The more and more that those communities were pushed into poverty, the more that the gang became a real criminal player. And so part of what Tone was trying to do was to think about, well, how do we pivot from one of the deadliest street gangs into a social movement like the Black Panthers? And so this was just in crass terms, it was a change management program. But it was just extraordinarily visionary and courageous for him to think about how to hack the culture of that organization. And it wasn't easy. And some accused him of just doing a vicious marketing campaign. The FBI was on record saying that. And he eventually did go to prison. And in prison, he was in solitary confinement for the first 3 years so that he couldn't communicate to the gang. And I remember him telling me every morning for 3 hours, he would just remind himself who he was and what his mission, you know, in the world was. I think there's so many people in our prison populations who have incredible hustle, incredible entrepreneurial skills, incredible vision, but they're just on the wrong side of the law. And so how do we create opportunities for prisoners to become entrepreneurs or to tap into opportunities in formal markets?
Alexa Clay and Kira Maya Phillips are the authors of The Misfit Economy, Lessons in Creativity from Pirates, Hackers, Gangsters, and Other Informal Entrepreneurs. They talked with Steve Paulson. Between the 1930s and 60s, writer Joseph Mitchell kept the New Yorker real by writing portraits of the city's misfits and outcasts, people like saloon keepers, street preachers, gypsies, and memorably, a 93-year-old seafooditarian who believed that his special diet would keep him alive for another 20 years. Joseph Mitchell died in 1996, and now he himself has been profiled in a new biography by Thomas Kunkel. Here's Doug Gordon's conversation with him.
Tom, do you think Mitchell's move from North Carolina to New York City is one of the reasons that he found himself drawn to writing about these outsiders, people like Lady Olga, the bearded lady, the street preachers, the gypsies, and the Mohawk construction workers who risked their lives building skyscrapers because Mitchell felt like an outsider himself?
No question about it. In fact, one of the things about Joe's notes I found very interesting, this theme of exile. He considered himself an exile, you know, basically this southern country boy abroad in New York, if you will. James Joyce would become Joe Mitchell's favorite writer. He shared that sense of exile that Joyce had. And it's absolutely the case that as an exile in New York, Joe, for starters, he sympathized with these characters that he found on the streets. And the other reason he was drawn to them, because somebody who came from a town of, you know, maybe 800 people, my goodness, he'd walk down 7th Avenue and literally everybody he saw was a new phenomenon to him. And he just saw stories everywhere. He couldn't write them fast enough. He was so interested in these colorful people. I think it's that sense of wonder and, yes, that sense of an outsider that finds other outsiders, you know, social outcasts, if you will, that imprinted on him. I mean, it's literally the thread that connects almost every person that Joe Mitchell wrote about in his entire career.
Yeah, I can't help but think of that quote from Mitchell's profile of Jane Barnell, the bearded lady who went by the stage name Lady Olga. You know the one I'm talking about, I think.
Yeah, you know, we're all freaks together.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. When Mitchell moved to New York, he worked as a newspaper reporter for the New York Herald Tribune and the World Telegram, wrote about celebrities and crime. He actually covered the Lindbergh kidnapping trial, and he saw six men being electrocuted, among other things. And then around 1937, he had an interview with the world's most influential anthropologist, Franz Boas. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. You know, it's kind of funny. Early in his New York career, Joe actually kind of, through a comedy of errors, he ended up being dismissed from his first newspaper, and he went on a sea cruise for a month. He ended up in Europe working as a deckhand on a freighter. And there he met a young man who years later would turn up to be one of Franz Boas's graduate assistants and kind of reintroduced himself to Joe. Fast forward, you know, in the late 30s, he introduced Joe to the most famous anthropologist in the world. And Joe did a six-part series. And for Joe Mitchell, it was kind of like, you know, a graduate course in anthropology.
Yeah.
And Boas, he had Joe read his book, which Joe did. And Joe was kind of a polymath. He was incredibly well-educated that way. But for Mitchell, the point was, at this point, he realized that if you were really going to write about people, you needed to write about their people, if you will. In other words, where do we come from? What are our influences? What shapes us? What are the forces that make us what we are. And it was really at that point that Joe Mitchell took his reporting to a very, very sophisticated new level.
Yeah. One of his most popular New Yorker stories is called Professor Seagull, and this one was published in 1942. It's a profile of a very colorful character named Joe Gould. Can you tell me about him?
Joe Gould was a very colorful figure in the Greenwich Village in the 20s, 30s, at a time when Greenwich Village was truly this very different bohemian, you know, a little bit intimidating part of New York, but it was really exciting. And Joe Gould was, he'd gone to Harvard, but no question, I think he had some emotional illness. He was alcoholic. He may have been a little crazy, but he was this very colorful figure that was known to a lot of the people in the village. So he would go to parties. He called himself Professor Seagull because he said when he was young he could understand the squawking of seagulls. And then he'd be at a party and he'd be prancing around like a seagull, and then he'd break into squawks talking in the seagull language. And I think for a lot of artists in the village, they took him under his wing, no pun intended, as a as a kind of a mascot. But the thing that interested Joe Mitchell most about Joe Gould was that Joe Gould said that he was compiling an oral history of our time that even by the time he had met Joe Mitchell was said to be several million words. Joe Mitchell thought he would be a good profile subject because of this compilation of the oral history of our time.
Gould is haunted by the fear that he will die before he has the first draft of the oral history finished. It is already 11 times as long as the Bible. He estimates that the manuscript contains 9 million words, all in longhand. It may well be the lengthiest unpublished work in existence. Gould does his writing in nickel composition books, the kind that children use in school, and the oral history and the notes he has made for it fill 270 of them, all of which are tattered and grimy and stained with coffee, grease, and beer. Using a fountain pen, he covers both sides of each page, leaving no margins anywhere, and his penmanship is poor. Hundreds of thousands of words are legible only to him. He has never been able to interest a publisher in the oral history. At one time or another, he has lugged armfuls of it into 14 publishing offices. Half of them said it was obscene and outrageous, and to get it out of there as quick as I could, he says. And the others said they couldn't read my handwriting. Experiences of this nature do not dismay Gould. He keeps telling himself that it is posterity he is writing for anyway. In his breast pocket, sealed in a dingy envelope, he always carries a will bequeathing 2/3 of the manuscript to the Harvard Library and the other 1/3 to the Smithsonian Institution. A couple of generations after I'm dead and gone, he likes to say, the PhDs will start lousing through my work. Just imagine their surprise. Why, I be damned, they'll say. This fellow was the most brilliant historian of the century. They'll give me my due. I don't claim that all of the oral history is first class, but some of it will live as long as the English language.
This passage really gives us a sense of the power of Joseph Mitchell's writing. The number of details that he includes is astonishing, and the sentences, they're so carefully constructed without drawing attention to themselves. How is Mitchell able to pull this off?
Well, I think one of the most important factors of Joe Mitchell's style, and frankly, you know, the reason he endures, is, as you said, this great power of observation. As good a listener as he was probably an even better watcher, and there just nothing escaped his notice. He was phenomenal. But he was not one of those writers who uses detail for detail's sake to sort of say, you know, to show off. He slips it in the most natural kind of ways to where it wants to be in the story, to reinforce the points he wants to make. The thing about Joe and as a writer, I kind of compare him to Cary Grant or somebody like that in films. They just make it look so easy. It seems so natural as if it's no work at all, when in fact any actor will tell you that that takes a phenomenal amount of work to make it look like that. And any writer will tell you that to make something come across as unforced and natural and smooth and flowing as Joe Mitchell's writing is takes an astonishing amount of effort. And Joe Mitchell literally labored over these sentences. He was known sometimes, of course, as a pre-computer age. He'd type up a draft, and then he'd get out his scissors and he'd start cutting paragraphs and sentences apart and start putting them back together with paper clips to just try and get a better sense of the movement and the rhythm of the writing. It was that painstaking.
And all that dedication really paid off. The Joe Gould essay was very popular, so popular that people sent money to the Joe Gould Fund in care of Mitchell at the New Yorker. And Gould stopped by the office so often, he really became a nuisance to Mitchell. What did that do to Gould and Mitchell's relationship?
A number of years after the first profile came out, Joe Gould became ill, physically ill, as well as having been emotionally ill and passed away. And in time, Joe Mitchell in the early 60s started going back over his notes about Joe Gould. And I think he was still trying to reconcile how he felt about Joe Gould. And it turns out that Joe Mitchell, not long after he wrote the first profile, Joe Mitchell essentially began to suspect that the oral history, Joe Gould's oral history, was not everything Gould had made it out to be. Joe Mitchell had seen parts of it, but very little of it was actually true oral history. A lot of it was just jibber-jabber and nonsense essays and that sort of thing. And eventually Mitchell kind of confronted Joe Gould about it, and Gould balked. But Mitchell was persuaded that an actual oral history didn't really exist. When Joe Gould died, you know, Mitchell began to wonder about the idea of writing about, and he continued to try and prove the fact that the oral history didn't exist. And he never really completely proved it exactly, but he did prove it to his own satisfaction. So he wrote this sequel that was published in 1964. It was much longer than the first, but the tone was much darker. There was some anger in it because Joe Mitchell was writing about the fact that he felt like he'd been somewhat misled and even betrayed by Joe Gould. But then the tone turns much lighter. There's a sense of forgiveness, and more interestingly, Mitchell basically says, am I really different than Joe Gould? You know, I've been telling people I'm going to write this big novel about New York City for most of my adult life, and it's in my head, and I can even describe to you what it looks like, and I've never written it. So really, why am I any different than Joe Gould? It's this really extraordinary piece of writing and introspection. And it's not only one of the best pieces of work that Joe Mitchell ever did, but it's also noteworthy because it literally is the last piece of writing that Joe Mitchell ever published while he was alive.
Yeah, and you mentioned this affinity in this essay, Joe Gould's Secret, this affinity between Gould and Mitchell that Mitchell talked about. And wasn't it sometime after the Joe Gould's Secret piece was published that somebody asked Joe Mitchell why he'd found Joe Gould so compelling?
It was, and Joe Mitchell's answer was, because he is me. Joe Gould tormented Joe Mitchell on a lot of levels, and well after Joe Gould was actually dead, he continued to torment him from the grave. And I think the torment was this sense that really, are we doppelgangers? We both talk to people for a living. We both write for a living. We are both trying to document this greater world of New York, and yet you're homeless, vagabond, and here I am with, you know, I've had a respectable career and a family and a nice apartment. I think there was a lot of guilt there. Yes, I do think that Joe Mitchell thought in many ways that he and Joe Gould were two elements of the same person.
Thomas Kunkel, he's the author of Man in Profile, Joseph Mitchell of the New Yorker. He talked with Doug Gordon. That's it for our conversation about The Outsider. Coming up, the Grammy-winning Cuban jazz pianist and composer Gonzalo Rubalcaba is on our minds this week. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. After more than half a century of feuding, the U.S. has reopened its embassy in Havana, Cuba. And among other things, that could set the stage for more Cuban-American musical exchanges. They've been few and far between, but often legendary. For instance, in the late 80s, the American jazz great Charlie Hayden met a young Cuban pianist named Gonzalo Rubalcaba. Hayden wound up becoming a kind of mentor figure to Rubalcaba, who became a major jazz figure in his own right. Charlie Hayden died last year, but shortly before that, he dug out some old recordings of two concerts he and Rubalcaba played in Japan. The album has just been released. It's called Tokyo Adagio. Steve Paulson has been listening to it a lot, and he got in touch with Rubalcaba to talk about it.
2 years before Charlie passed away, I think he was looking at some of the recording he did, live recording he did in the past, and he found those tapes. And he called me and he said, I found this, and I know you have it too, and I would like you to listen to that, and let me know if you agree to release that, because I think it's a beautiful music.
So he knew he was dying at that point. He knew that this would be coming out right around the time, or maybe even after he actually died.
He knew that he was very sick. But at the same time, I think Charlie was a very strong person inside. So I think he assumed that he could, you know, go ahead. So I just follow him, and I agree what he wants to do. Because we have more than the large and deep professional relationship we had, also we have a very important human relationship, personal relationship.
And you had known him for what, 20 years or so? You'd worked with him on various projects.
Yes. Yeah. We met in 86 in Havana, jazz festival in Havana.
And you were very young at that time, right? What, 23 years old, something like that?
About that, yes. I remember he plays first with his band, and then I play with my band after that. And when we finished, he came back to the stage, and then he said, we should play. We had to find a piano and a place where we can jam a little bit. And then the next day, we went to the studios. This is studio recordings in Havana. And we spent like 3 hours playing. He asked the guys there to record that jam, that moment. He took that cassette, and he showed that cassette to Bruce Lumbau.
At Blue Note Records.
And Blue Note Records. So that was the beginning of my signing a contract with Blue Note. Bruce came to Havana in 89 with the idea to sign me. And it was impossible because the embargo and all mm-hmm. the...
So there was no American record company that could sign a Cuban no. musician. You had to do it through other means.
Exactly. So they talked to EMI Toshiba in Japan. They asked them to sign me. And they required to see a concert because they didn't know about me. So we played in Montreal in Switzerland, jazz festival in 1990. A concert with Charlie and Paul Motion, and then the Japanese came to see the concert. When we finished the concert, they decided to sign me. Doing that way, Blue Note could release those albums in the United States because it was coming from a Japanese record company.
A way to get around the exactly. restrictions, the American law. You played with Charlie Hayden for years. And as you said, it was more than just a professional relationship. It was, mm-hmm. I mean, you two were very close. He was much older than you. He was a jazz legend. What was it like to play with Charlie Hayden?
I learned a lot musically, but also about life. Because we were able to talk, not only to play, but to talk. And to talk about everything. Music, family, economy, business, politics, everything.
Now, the music on this album, Tokyo Adagio, it's very meditative, and it's just the two of you on piano mm-hmm. and bass. There's a lot of stillness here. Mm-hmm. How would you describe this music?
It's part of the moment. where the intimacy was one of the most important elements in this duet. Charlie was always open to work with different composers, no matter age or nationality or styles. So you see the program, we have just one piece from Charlie, which is Sandino, but also we have a very emblematic bolero from Mexico, which is Solamente Una Vez, and one of my pieces from the 80s that I have to say that when I composed that piece, Transparence, I was really stimulated by Charlie's vision about music, how to do music, how to play music, how to produce sound. Charlie had that capacity to say a lot with very little elements. He was able to show and to convince the people how deep was his music, how clear was his message, with very few elements. He was a very spiritual person. And maybe that was the first and the most important point to us to connect. I always say that the music, we cannot lie with the music we do. The music is exactly 90% what we are.
This is fascinating to hear you say this. I mean, do you feel that while you're playing? I mean, do you feel a spiritual connection with Charlie Hayden as the two of you are making music together?
Definitely. When you play a piece of music, and then this person has understood what you did, what you're trying to say musically, and he became part of that, adding the other portion we need, he's connected with you in some way. It happened with Charlie every time we play. It was maybe the factor, the element that keep us working together for a long, long time.
Back up for a moment and ask a bit about your own personal history. You grew up in Havana, Cuba. You come from a family of musicians. Your father was a famous musician in Cuba. Did you grow up playing jazz?
I found jazz when I was about 12 or 13 years old, when I discovered that my family had very old vinyl albums from Dizzy Gillespie or Charlie Parker or even older. Jimmy Dorsey, Benny Goodman, and also at the school. I mean, in Cuba, the music school we had is totally 100% classical.
So you grew up actually playing classical music. You only discovered jazz later.
But I found some students around that they were already involved in improvisation, jazz improvisation.
Was jazz even played much at this time? I mean, we're talking post-revolution Cuba. What did people think about jazz in Cuba at that time?
At that point in the 60s and also the early 70s, there was a lot of control about what kind of music we should hear in Cuba. Jazz and rock and roll and pop music and everything coming from the United States or from any capitalist country, the music from those countries, it was seemed like the music of the enemy.
I want to pick up the threads of your own story. You left Cuba. You moved to the United States. You settled in Florida, where you still live. Why did you choose to leave Cuba?
I'm part of one more generation that understood that Cuba at some point became very limited to develop the kind of life, family life, professional life we wanted.
But even once you did eventually move to Florida, I've heard that you had some tough times in those early years. I mean, there were a lot of Cuban exiles in Miami who were really angry at you because you did not denounce Castro. And sometimes they would protest your shows. They spit at people who went to your concerts. They threw bottles at people. It must have been a really hard time.
Well, this is maybe the price to keep and maintain your own way to describe your memories, your story, and your own way to be critical or not. The point that I found here in Miami at that time, I'm talking about 96, I refused to talk about Cuba in the way I heard, because I believe that things in life are not black and white. Maybe that position and to talk about Cuba was what provoked that reaction.
So you're basically saying it was not possible to have a more nuanced response to Cuba. I mean, you, especially living in Miami, you were just, if you were not an outspoken opponent of Fidel, you were going to get in trouble.
I wasn't the only one. I think I was part of a generation that had the same position. And not because we were ignoring the situation inside of Cuba. We know exactly what happened in those 50 years in Cuba. I'm 52 years old. I know exactly how the people in Cuba feel, how they think, what they need. But if I started in Cuba and I had in the 80s and the 70s, people that trained me, I mean, at the school, I have a great teachers, I have people that help me to develop as a musician, I think I should say that.
Yeah.
So I'm clear about everything. But I think I have the right to speak and to say what I believe has been part of my reality.
So what's your take on this whole process of normalizing relations between these two countries, between the United States and Cuba? Do you think that will really open things up musically between the two countries?
I think it would be a very slow process. It would take time. Considering that 55 years of the same mental structure. So I think it's great to develop all those steps of a relationship between Cuba and United States. But my opinion is that it would not happen quickly. It would be a long process.
Jazz pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba is now an American citizen living in South Florida. His new album with the late Charlie Hayden, called Tokyo Adagio, has just been released 10 years after it was recorded. Steve Paulson talked with him. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangakar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.